Excellent. Thank you very much. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, which is Professor T. Noyan from University of Utah. And Professor Noyan will be talking to us about value capture. Take it away.
Hello. Hello. What I'm trying to navigate, I think you're all familiar with now, is the incredible emotional divide between the fact that it's pleasant and in the afternoon here, and here it's 8:30. I just got my kids into the car. I'm not sure. This shirt I didn't actually change, but right below screen, there's actually an applesauce spill from my two-year-old. And now, like, here's coffee. And, you know, there's, I think one of the special things about Zoom life right now is this moment where you don't have a commute. You just have total whiplash. You have about 2 minutes to recover from putting your kids in the car to being in front of an august, you know, crowd of your heroes trying to look like a real philosopher instead of a parent. All right. So let me give you let me share my screen. Share. This is the right one. Does that look all right to everyone? You see? Excellent. All right. So I want to give you a talk that might be a little too broad. It's more of a book than a paper, probably. And it is the development at the end of the previous project. So I've been working across two different fields that I think there are not many people that are currently working on. Half of my life is in aesthetics, and half of my life is in social epistemology. For me, they're really, really similar topics. If it means something, for example, my aesthetics class, my social epistemology classes always start with Audre Lorde on Poetry is Not a Luxury. That, I think, is the connection I see between them. And what I keep trying to explain is something like, when I'm working on social epistemology, a lot of the things I'm trying to understand are things like particular technologies, like Twitter, right? How does Twitter work? And a lot of the times, when I look to philosophy for help with understanding the nature of Twitter, a lot of the traditional epistemology, especially the work on testimony that I was steeped in growing up, doesn't help me as much. And I find that the aesthetics work is much more helpful. I mean, if this helps, for example, I've been writing something on Twitter, and the things I found most useful are Ted Cohen on the aesthetics of jokes and work on the aesthetic of haiku, right? People thinking about the emotional impact of short, constrained communication. So the larger connection I'm seeing between aesthetics and social epistemology really is that social epistemology right now has come to really understand that a lot of what matters is the technology of communication. And the philosophy of art has actually spent its entire lifetime basically obsessed with the fine details of the technology of communication, right? How a subtle shift in medium changes the way we record things, the way we connect things, what we can communicate, how we can communicate it. So I say this because the talk I'm going to give you is about, it's a talk loosely in ethics, value theory, and practical reasoning about value capture, about what happens, about our relationship to metrics and simplified values, especially in our institutional life. But this project actually started at the end point of an aesthetics project. So I've spent the last 7 years of my life working on a theory of the philosophy of games. My book, actually, it's right here, hold on. Hey, look at this book. It's this, by the way, I love this cover. The reason that I didn't get stuck with a standard Oxford boring stock photo fancy art cover, sorry, I've just insulted everyone in the room, is that this cover is by an undergraduate in a game design program who made this as a poster for one of my talks. And I was like, can I have that, please? And it ended up being our first paying job. So really excited about this. So the thing about this book is, my theory is, in general, that most of work on the philosophy of games, especially in aesthetics, has focused on games as part of a familiar kind of art that we know, as a fiction or a cinema, right? And use those kinds of theories. And I was really worried that I was reading a bunch of work on games as an art form that ignored skill, choice, decision, struggle. And the theory that I ended up coming up with, the account of this book, is that the game designer doesn't just tell stories or tell environments, but they manipulate who you will be in the game. In particular, they specify affordances and they tell you your motivations. The central locus of this book is this quote from my favorite board game designer, Rainer Knizia, like well-known as the Mozart of German board game design. And he said something like, the most important tool I have as a game designer is the points, because the points tell the players what to care about during the game. And if you look at this, and you're like, that's cool, but if you look at this as a philosopher of art and a philosopher who works on practical reasoning and value theory, you're like, whoa, that seems incredibly important, right? The game designer tells the players what to care about during the game, or at least they specify a skeleton of caring, and players take that up. So the center of this book becomes the claim that the artistic medium of game design is agency itself, right? The game designer specifies abilities, problems, but goals and motivations, and those all work in tune to create this practical experience. But the big upshot of this is this view, we can talk about later, it's not gonna be as much in this talk, that we have this, that games expose this capacity for us to just be exposed to points and then just jump onto them, focus on them, and absorb ourselves in caring about them. So in the book, I say that playing games in a certain way is really valuable because we get to jump into different agencies. The big sexy claim of the book is sexy to me. I don't know, you all might find it boring, but the big claim is that games constitute a library of agencies and we can explore different mental styles and increase our inventory. I, for example, learned how to do analytic philosophy from chess. Basically, I was not good at it, and I learned that mental mode. But the end of the book is this begins to worry about gamification. And there's this background thought that games are wonderful because you get to slip in and out of specifications of a particular caring, and you end it, and you can reflect on it from a distance. But something else happens with movement towards gamifying work, gamifying education. So at the end of this book, I introduced this concept that I'm going to talk about, value capture. But what's in the end of the book is really crude. And I've been thinking about it for like 3 years. And so this is the expansion of really rough three paragraphs from the end of the book where I'm trying to figure out value capture. All right, that's the intro. So value capture, what I'm interested in is a distinctive problem that happens when we internalize values, institutionally metrics, measures, and scores. By the way, I'm gonna focus for various reasons during this talk on quantified metrics, but that's just a test case for this. One of the early things that drove me into this project was, I'm not sure we have the same language in the US and the UK, but I worked in the US as the department lead for what they call assessment, which is creating quantified evidence of student performance to achieve specified learning outcomes, right? And one of the things that I was obsessed with was why every university qualitative statement of its educational mission was bullshit. And why, there's a background question about whether or not these are necessarily bullshit. We'll get to that. Anyway, so I just want to say that this includes simplified things like bureaucratic statements of missions in educational institutions, but also particularly metrics and measures. So quick story, true life story. So this is a story I got from my mother-in-law, Chris. So Chris and her husband, Tom, are retired and they planned a Roman holiday. They live in Wyoming. They've barely been in Europe. And she said that so they were going to meet up with an old set of friends of theirs, Shelly and John. So Shelly and John used to live in town with them, moved away for 10 years. And Chris said she was so excited that she was just fantasizing about getting to spend time with them in Rome. And then she said her entire experience of her Roman holiday was completely dominated by Shelly and John's relationships to their Fitbits, right? She said things like, oh, I got tickets to, do you want to get tickets to the opera tomorrow? And they would say, no, opera involves too much sitting. We're not going to meet our step goals. We can't go to the opera. Or she would say something like, do you want to meet for dinner in half an hour? And her friends would say, no, we haven't met our step goals for today. You have dinner. We're going to go walking. We'll see you tomorrow. I find this really striking, right? And I really want to understand what's going on here. And my first suspicion as a first pass, it did not like Shelley and John formulated themselves the theory that they care more about exercise than friendship or art or cultural touring. My guess is, and this is what I'm gonna try to work out, that there's just no art bit or there's no friend bit, right? And the fact that the Fitbit is there and so salient that something about the ready access to the quantification of an evaluation that's just there somehow dominates their decision process, kind of unconsciously. So here's the phenomenon I want to study, value capture. So value capture happens when an agent's values are rich and subtle, and they enter into a social environment that presents simplified, typically quantified versions of those values. And then those simplified values come to dominate the agent's practical reasoning of the relevant domain. So this slide is now like a year and a half old. And I should say, this is not quite right. This definition needs to be revised, and because this formulation makes it sound like it only applies to agents that have already formulated their values, right? The thing that I'm really interested in, this should be hopefully be clear later, is that there are cases where an agent is in the process of developing rich and subtle values, and these offer a kind of shortcut, right? So examples, you start exercising for your health, but you end up trying to max out your per week step counts, or you start controlling your diet for health, but you end up trying to hit optimum targets for weight and BMI. And I don't know where I got this example. You go into philosophy grad school with a vast love of truth, but you come out obsessed with citation rates and the status of your publications in some ranked list, or the status of your institution in some ranked list. Or you start tweeting for the sake of truth and justice in conversation, and you end up aiming mostly at producing viral content. P.S. If that last one interests you, I'm not going to talk about it much, but I have a separate like practical application paper of this called How Twitter Gamifies Communication that's already out and was written for teaching to undergraduates. But it's kind of the undergrad friendly version of this paper just about Twitter. So if you're interested in that, that's already online. So I just want to focus on this notion of coming to dominate the agent's practical reasoning. So I think there are two ways. I don't have great names for this, but there are two ways this can happen. One is what I want to call pure value capture, and the other is, this is what I wish I had a better name for, proxy value capture. And so what I'm thinking really is this. Sometimes in cases of value capture, the way you would articulate your value to yourself, or the formulation that you would accept reflectively, changes. And I think I can see this happening with things like money, right? Someone goes to a job, various reasons, and then at some point they would formulate to themselves that their goal is to make more money. Other cases I think that are much more common, especially in for me, at least. By the way, this paper is a lot of self-reflection and self-therapy because I'm very vulnerable to this kind of thing. Is a case in which you would still articulate in the abstract your value in the same way, but every time you come to a decision point or an evaluation of a specific case, you substitute the institutional simplified version. So what I mean here is, imagine if you ask me, what do you want from philosophy? And I say, I want my philosophy to be deep and profound. And then every time I'm writing a paper and I decide how to write it, I think, what would I write down would get me into the highest ranked journal, right? Or if I thought to myself afterwards, was this a good paper? And then I look at it and I ask, and I look at its citation rate, right? So a lot of the times I think the institutional proxies insert themselves into many or most of our practical cases, even though they leave our articulated reflection behind. I mean, I actually suspect in that case, the proxy is effectively the real value, but that's a debate for another day, right? So those are two things that happen. I think the latter is actually much more common. So I'm really interested in this possibility that once we have a quantified representation of value, the clarity of it trumps subtler values. And also when it's not quantified, but just institutionally standardized, right? So one thing I want to be clear, that value capture is not the same as perverse incentives. So perverse incentives typically leverage some general desire for an instrumental resource. That is, you don't have to change your core values to be perversely incentivized. Someone just offers you money and that's an instrumental resource. I'm interested specifically in the cases in which there's some effective internalization and transformation of core values, right? So intentional gamification is one path, but the most interesting pathway to me is the one in which institutional pressures towards metrification, which often happen for very good reasons, like transparency. By the way, there's a spin-off of this paper just about transparency. So if you want to talk about institutional transparency, we can do that in Q&A. But there are many cases where an institution, for totally good internal record-keeping reasons, transparency, generates a simplified metric. And then once it's there, it has this seductive clarity that pulls people's motivations towards it, even if it wasn't formulated to change people's motivations, but simply formulated for, say, oversight. So here's an example. I know that a few people in this room come from the legal world, so I'm really interested in your response to this. So one of the reasons I want to focus so much on the metric stuff is it's actually really well empirically studied. And this is one of the things, especially for the people in the room, I know there are a few people in the room that focus on social epistemology. I think there's this really valuable literature on the sociology and anthropology of bureaucracy and quantification that's incredible. I see a few of you nodding, you know this, but I think a lot of us don't access this material, even though it's put in our terms. And P.S., if you want to know why it's put in our terms, if you go through this literature and trace it down, you keep seeing footnotes to Ian Hacking. So I think this is an empirical realm that was deeply influenced by a lot of people, but especially by Ian Hacking, who sets the framework, and then they run off and do empirical work, and philosophers mostly ignore them. Anyway, so this is a study by Wendy Esplund and Michael Sauter. Wendy Esplund, by the way, is, in my mind, the ruling thinker in the sociology of quantification. All her work is amazing, but this book in particular is kind of the summation. This is a 10-year empirical study of how American legal educational culture and American legal culture in general changed when the US News and World Report started issuing its yearly law school rankings, right? And what they say is it changes everything. The name of the book gives you a hint of how it changes. So one thing it does is that they say that it decreases value plurality throughout the system. So before the US News and World Report, different schools used to have different missions. Some would be interested in getting people in the Supreme Court clerkships, some are more interested in theory, some are more interested in money, some are interested in serving the local community or social justice missions. And what they find is the rankings matter so much that schools that don't target, spend most or all of their resources targeting exactly what the algorithm measures, those schools plunge in the rankings and lose funding and lose students. And so schools are forced to pursue just what these metrics measure, which is really thin, by the way. It's like GPA, LSAT, outgoing employment. It's a very simple algorithm. So it plunges schools in conform. But notice what I've said before is still, it's like it's an incentivization case. It's a perverse incentive. It's not a value capture case. But they do have this incredible example of what looks to me like a pure value capture case. So what they say is before the law school rankings, prospective law school students, when they were trying to choose what law school they would go to, because they were faced with largely qualitative descriptions of the different values embedded in different schools, that would trigger in them a process of figuring out why am I going to law, right? And what they say is, and this is well-researched partially because all the stuff happens on archived internet forums, like there are forums for student discussion, so this is all available to them. Now students just don't go through this process. They take their mission to be to go to the best school, and they take the US News and World Report just to tell them what best is. So the existence of the rankings has short-circuited something. So I want to translate this into philosophical terminology. And this is basically what this rest of this talk is going to be about. So here's the thought. Value capture disrupts the process of value self-determination. We should be in some, let me asterisk, significantly, for many of our values, significantly tailoring those values to our psychologies and our place in the world. And value capture cuts off and impedes that process in various ways and encourages us to substitute prefabricated and standardized values for tailored ones. Or if you want that boiled down into a TED Talkish slogan, with value capture, an agent outsources the process of self-determination. You're outsourcing it to US News and World Report, to Mark Zuckerberg, to Apple, all of which might strike you as moderately alarming. Or if you're in the philosophy scene, I think there are a lot of people that were for significant amounts of time outsourcing their values to Brian Leiter, which I find really disturbing. Okay, let me fill this out. So part of what's going on here is when you enter an activity, okay, in the background, I've been finding really useful this account by Tal Brewer in the book Retrieval of Ethics. And one of the ideas of Retrieval of Ethics is that the value of an activity isn't obvious to us. What happens is we spend time with that activity, and as we perform that activity, its value becomes clearer to us. In fact, he describes what he calls a dialectical procedure where you start doing the activity, you get some semblance of value, that changes how you do the activity, which sharpens your view. Anyway, so it takes a long amount of time. But more than that, I also think in a loose class of activities often have multiple forms that have different values. For example, So I used to be very sedentary. My body was falling apart. My mind was falling apart. And I was super depressed. And I was like, I need to exercise. And before I started doing it, I had one image of what exercise was, which was pounding out miles on a treadmill. And I realized, actually, it's incredibly rich and variable, right? Long distance running is very zen-like. trail running is really aesthetically complicated, ultramarathoning is grueling, deadlifting is super intense, and then rock climbing, which became my kind of like chosen sport, rock climbing is really kind of intellectual and balancing and delicate. And even if you pick one of these things, right, the way you approach it, so even in rock climbing, there are different ways to approach it that embed and engage different values. So you could do it in a very outdoorsy, rambling kind of way, in a very danger-oriented way, in a way that really emphasizes like your pure development of power, or in a way that emphasizes like very delicate puzzle solving, right? There are different ways to approach. And what you do is when you wander through a life with exercise, with rock climbing, you try these out, you figure out what fits you, you figure out what's good for you. But here's the account. If you're value captured by Fitbit, you outsource this process of value determination and you permit the technology to set the evaluative standard for you. Another way to put it is Fitbit embeds a way of evaluating the activity. And when you internalize that, you're internalizing a prefabricated and fixed mode of evaluation. This is, by the way, connected. Sorry, this is a huge network of different papers I've been working on, to Trust as an Unquestioning Attitude, which is a paper that tries to talk about trust in technology and says that what we're doing when we trust technologies is we're opening our cognitions and like kind of plugging them in and trying to make them like internal parts of our internal mental faculties. Okay, so one thing I should say, I'm not saying that when you strap on a Fitbit, you're value captured, period. I'm saying that there's a you could wear a Fitbit and use that as information those at arm's length. I'm saying that Fitbit encourages and makes easier a procedure where you, some people, permit yourself to be value captured and internalize this value. So what happens in, what's the harm in value capture? There are two possible ways to put it. One is that it damages your autonomy directly by taking the continued adjustment of your values out of your hand. And the other is a more instrumental claim that value capture decreases the fittingness of your values to your particularities by making the formulation responsive to your own interests. And instead of having the formulation of your values responsive to your own interests in psychology and experience, it's responsive to the interests of large scale institutions. By the way, my claim here, a few comments. One, number one, that it damages your autonomy directly. I'm not going to argue a huge amount for that just because I think it depends so much on your theory of autonomy. And I don't want to go through 50 different theories of autonomy. So depending on your theory of autonomy, it might just turn out this direct damage for autonomy. I can give you an argument for number two, though. The other thing I want to say is my claim isn't that you must never value capture. Rather, it's that there is a harm or a downside and a cost, and we should get clear about the cost. Sometimes that cost might be worth paying. For example, if I had a choice to value, I get asked this question a lot, but if I could value capture the world to get people to take their fucking vaccines, I would. But there are other cases where the good does not outweigh the harm. So I want to get a clear picture of the harm of value capture. So here's the argument for number two, the tailoring, the fittingness. So this is really based on a wonderful book of Elijah Milgram's, Practical Induction. I think it's a little too little read. So the thought in this book is that we don't derive our values in their particular formulations from the top down for some a priori abstract conception of the good. Rather, we live life with a particular conception of with a particular set of goals or conception of our values. And then we get feedback from how our life goes. And that feedback involves our sense of happiness, our sense of depression, our sense of engagement, our sense of boredom. By the way, if you want this book in a quick little kernel, you should read his later paper on being bored out of one's mind, which suggests that being bored is a feedback signal that the current set of goals and roles you have for yourself isn't good for you. And I mean, I think his model really is like, if you're really bored and you decide to change career paths and what you're doing in your life, that is accurately modeled by this view that you're getting feedback from your rich emotional experience of the world that something is wrong with your current formulation of your goals and values. So this means if you go through this procedure, this means that you'll be able to tailor and fine tune your values in response to subtle and phenomenological experiences of the world. And value capture diminishes that tailoring by pegging your values to various institutional processes that reflect large-scale institutional interests rather than your own. Again, sometimes it might be worth doing that, but I think in many cases, what you lose is this self-fine-tuning. So you might say, but autonomy is self-rule. Aren't we autonomous so long as we choose which rules to follow? Isn't value capture just voluntarily choosing an external metric, which is literally giving oneself a rule to measure oneself by? What's more, there are many gamifications like Fitbit and Duolingo, which are aimed at overcoming weakness of the will. Like, how could choosing a metric, voluntarily choosing a metric for the purpose of increasing, of getting over weakness of the will, possibly be a loss of autonomy? So one way to put it is the initial decision to outsource may be a voluntary act, but what you're outsourcing is a fundamental part of your continuously self-determining agency. Right? You're outsourcing your capacity to further tailor and adjust your values in response to your experience of living in the world. The initial act may be autonomous, but it damages your autonomy going forward. So to put it in, I think, the fancy way that philosophers like, in value capture, you may be self-determined, but insofar as you're value captured, you're no longer self-determining. Another way to put it that might be useful is, I do think that something like Fitbit or Duolingo increases your willpower, but I take this outsourcing metaphor to be really powerful. It increases your willpower insofar as you align yourself precisely with that evaluation. Otherwise, I mean, my image is, it's kind of like a store-bought extension of the will, which increases your motivation, but only towards a target that's embedded in this particular technology. And that's a weird trade-off, right? I just want to be clear that what I'm saying is not that value capture damages your autonomy when it happens without you knowing it. I think that a lot of people would agree with that. My claim is that when you knowingly and voluntarily participate in value capture, you are damaging your autonomy. It'd be useful here to distinguish, following Nomi or Polly, between a kind of minimal sense of autonomy, which is constituting responsibility, and autonomy is something like an ideal. And I'm not arguing that when we permit value capture, we lose this minimal sense of autonomy where we're no longer responsible for your actions. I'm arguing that in this case, we fall short of a reasonable ideal of autonomy. So I'm gonna skip a little bit. Okay. There's technical stuff for theorists of autonomy that we can talk about later. So why? So I wanna suggest, so this slide is a little vision of the future. So this is gonna go by fast, I'll slow down for it. I want to suggest that value capture substitutes for a live and adjustable value, a value that's narrow, that resists reinterpretation, and that's inflexible because it's embedded in institutions. Second TED Talk slogan, value should be individually tailored, but in value capture, you buy your values off the rack. Actually, let me take this back. underrepresents the problems of value capture, because if you buy clothes off the rack, you can still tailor them. But what I'm going to argue is that in value capture cases, exactly what makes them appealing is exactly what makes them resist tailoring, that is embeddedness in a large-scale institution. So it's like, oh, I guess it's more like buying an Apple iPhone that you're never allowed to open, right? Okay, so one big question you'd have is this inevitable or is just contingent crappiness? Could the answer be the metrics we have might be terrible, but we should just get better ones? I want to claim it's not that it's a necessary connection, but that it's functionally tight. That is, it's no accident, that there's a tight relationship between why institutions make metrics the way they make, why they're seductive to us, and why they're harmful to internalize. So for this, it's really helpful to look at this rich body of work in the history and sociology of quantification and its relationship to bureaucracy. So the kind of, I suspect that some people in this room, from my guess, know this book, but Theodore Porter is a historian who is kind of the founder of this modern empirical history, anthropology, sociology, study, and quantification. And he was really heavily influenced by Ian Hacking. There are Hacking footnotes all over this thing. And what Porter suggests through this book is that he's not against quantification, but he thinks that there is, that qualitative knowledge and quantitative knowledge each have their own advantages. And he's worried about political and social circumstances that push us towards quantification all the time, in all circumstances, even when it's inappropriate. So here's his basic view. He thinks the quantification of knowledge trades nuance and sensitivity for portability and aggregability. That is, qualitative knowledge is nuanced, context sensitive, and information rich, but it travels really badly between people of different contexts. It typically requires high shared context to properly interpret. Quantification, especially in an institutional context, And by the way, I want to say, what I'm saying is not about quantification in some kind of abstract, but quantification in institutional context. Quantification in institutional context does what it does by stripping off all the nuance that requires shared background knowledge to interpret and finding some context-insensitive kernel, isolating that, right? Which makes information A, easy to travel, and B, makes information readily aggregatable. Here's an example from the book, which I love. And by the way, this is interesting because it shows that this is a spectrum, because this is a quantitative-ish qualitative measure. So he says that we used, I just need to, let me have some coffee. I'm too excited. I love this example. So he says that we used to measure land in the unit of the height. By the way, by we, this is an English measure. I just pretended to be English. Anyway, you found these things like this across Europe. So we used to measure land in a unit called the hide, which is the unit of land required to feed an average family. So notice that a hide is going to be very variable as a measure of space, right? A hide by a rich river is small. A hide in a forest is medium. A hide in a plain is big. A hide in a desert is huge. And it'll also depend on things about seasonality, right? Hides are really information rich. Think about what you're giving if a king says, give every soldier 2 hides of land. But hides to administrate require incredibly rich local knowledge. So what Porter says is when you shift from locally centered administration to centralized bureaucracies in different cities, invariably, governments stop using units like the hide and shift to things like the acre, which are easy to control and aggregate from a distant center without rich local knowledge. Another way to put it comes from James Scott. So in Seeing Like a State, James Scott says that states, and by states he means large corporations, globalized capitalism, and governments, can only see the parts of the world that have been rendered into formats or processable through vast administration, that have basically quantified standardized measures that are easy to aggregate. Higher level administration, he says, needs information from these its various subunits, standardized and quantified, so they aggregate it and bring the entire organization and the world it's acting on into view. The way that he puts it is that states only find the parts of the world legible that are in the four parts of the world that are easily measured in large-scale standardized measures. Those are the only parts of the world states can find legible and coherently act on. It's also important here to distinguish between quantification and standardization. Notice you can have quantification without standardization. So every teacher could make up their own scale and rubric, right? In order to get aggregation, you need to standardize the input rules and the processing rules. And I think a really good example here is, so in the States, we call it grade point average. I'm not sure what the UK calls it, but every student has a letter grade, and those letter grades are rendered into, in the US, a 4-point scale where an A counts as a 4 and a B counts as a 3. So it's easy to render a student's entire educational career into a single number, an average of all their grades. And it's easy to, say, example, generate a grade average for an entire department or an entire school district. So notice, you could have education without quantified or quantified equivalent grading. I could give my students rich evaluations based on their interests, their emotional state, their life goals. I could evaluate my nursing students completely different from my future philosophy students, completely different from my future writer students, right? There's no reason for me to compare them in our one-on-one educational process in the classroom. But those kind of qualitative measures don't aggregate well and aren't really comprehensible to, say, the dean of my university who comes from the business school, right? So something like grade point average, since it's a universal standard across the educational system, is easily comprehensible, easily usable by large-scale administrations. So let me sum up all this stuff. Institutions have a primary functional interest. They need to manage information over a vast domain. And that interest is served by two standard mechanisms, quantification and standardization. And those mechanisms generate the following problematic features essential to how they serve the main function. Let me go back and just point out something that I'm trying to be careful about here. I'm not presuming that institutions are evil. So the argument I'm giving is different from the argument that it's all capitalism and capitalism is evil. One of the interesting things about Scott is he finds the same problem occurring both in capitalism and in centralized communisms. He puts it as an information aggregation problem that comes from large-scale organized institutions, right? So I'm not attributing to institutions here any kind of evil. I'm simply attributing to them an interest in managing information over a large scale bureaucracy. So here are the features they generate. One, the information is narrowed. So that is exactly what we're talking about with Porter. It's been standardized and stripped out of various context sensitive features. And notice, as Scott says, anything that doesn't impinge on the metric is invisible at the institution. So I want to suggest is that insofar as we adopt those values, and insofar as our values drive what we spend our time attending to, individuals get an analogous effect. If a value is tightly specified, then individuals are more likely to dismiss what falls outside that the metric as unimportant. Think of the business person who thinks that anything that doesn't lead to money is unimportant. The second is they're finished. We can express our values in open-ended ways that are open to a certain amount of interpretation. Health, education, we can interpret these in different ways. But notice that in order to get this aggregation effect, you need to standardize the input rules. So we need to reformulate the input rules for these various standards to remove the need for interpretation. That's what makes information readily portable and aggregatable. So we remove this open-endedness. And last, there's an embeddedness, right? The reason that off-the-rack values work so well and efficiently is they're embedded in an institutional infrastructure with institutional language and technology, and so they resist further tailoring. You can't tinker easily with the way Fitbit counts steps. And in my institution, I couldn't tinker with the way that learning outcomes were quantitatively measured, right? All this requires standardization, and all this fixes the criteria for inputting things into the metrics across an institution. So to summarize, institutional metrics are designed according to alien interests, like bureaucratic usability, portability, and aggregability. When you internalize them, you let those interests play a powerful determining role in the formulation of your own values, and the form and embeddedness of institutional metrics resists tailoring and customization. So why is it so seductive? I'm gonna skip a little bit. So one thing, we can talk about this later, I have another paper on this. You get fluency effects from the universal familiarity of quantification, but here's to me, the more important one. This is from the theory of games. So I think the world as we find it for us is quite value nauseating. So values are very subtle. They're often inchoate, they're very plural, and they're hard to measure off against each other. They're hard to commensurate, and they're hard to apply. And what I mean is something like, okay, here's some values I have. I value about raising happy children. I value good research. I value my own health. I value happiness. I value my friends. I don't exactly know how to trade these off against each other. There's no clear way to do it. And even when we focus on one of them, it's really hard to figure out how you apply it to a particular situation. Like, I want to be a good parent and raise a good child. And sometimes, I think a lot of you might be faced with a situation like this. My child is running around, taking his clothes off, screaming a story about how he's Superman and flinging things around when he's supposed to be going to school. And I think to myself, am I raising an undisciplined monster or a happy free spirit? Like, how do I know, right? But in games, we know exactly what we're going for. We know exactly how it's measured. We know exactly how to commensurate all the different qualities. And we know exactly how well we stand because there's points. Here's another way to put it. In games, we simplify what we value, and that gives us a kind of value clarity. And I think that's kind of an existential balm. So in my theory, like, this is one of the reasons we play games, for this temporary relief from the value nausea of the world. So when you internalize a quantified value system, you bring the feeling of value clarity into real life precisely because the value systems are narrowed, right? And it's even more powerful when you add standardization. So one way to put it is, so a lot of my experience of life is of this gulf of value intelligibility between me and other people in the world, like trying to explain to someone why I care about philosophy, or I see Derek Matravers on my screen, and I have a suspicion that if I tried to explain my interest in noise rap to Derek, we would have this gulf of like unintelligibility. But Derek, let's have a drink and talk about my love of Kanye, and we'll see how we do this. But if you've all converged on the same standardized value system, then that gulf disappears, right? Such metrics are designed to make communication and justification easy. And so instead of this painful distance of value understanding, you get this pre-engineered harmony from this standardization of value expressions. By the way, this slide is autobiographical and consists of me sitting in committee meetings in a university trying to understand why people would use certain language, like student engagement is best practices, and everyone would nod as if something had been explained, and I would just be really confused. I'm gonna skip a little more. Yeah, okay, so one more thought. Is it an accident that institutions create for their internal self-organization metrics that are so seductive? So what I wanna suggest is that no, institutions need clear policies and metrics for internal coherence and the ability to follow goals and plans consistently over time. And if you believe, as I do, a basically Bratman type view, and I noticed that Richard Holton is in this room, so also in my mind, a Holton type view, that group agents need clear policies. Sorry, individual agents need clear policies for similar reasons to stay coherent over time and consistent over time. But group agents are subject to greater demands for explicitness. So me, as an individual, here are some actual policies that I use in my actual life. One is make sure you exercise every day until you have a pleasant, warm feeling. And another is don't have a cocktail before 6 p.m. unless you really, really, really need it. So I can use these policies because I know what a pleasant, warm feeling feels like to me, and I know what really, really, really needing it feels like to me. But these are subtle bits of internal phenomenon. Group agents can't use this. And so group agential level policies can't use subtle phenomenological contours. So one way to put it is, if you're internalizing group level set policies into your practical reasoning, then you're giving up the capacity to set policies based on these phenomenological contours. But they're extra clear and easier to apply, which can be extra appealing to us. So we may internalize them. And to do so, we have to give up on acting from sensitive, subtle internal phenomenon. Again, sometimes it might be worth doing it, right? We can adopt clear, bright lines and share them with people. I often think like Alcoholics Anonymous is a case where there's an effective case of doing this. But again, there's also a trade-off. So by the way, the claim isn't the metrics are bad. The claim is that institutions need hyper-explicit values to function. And it's often bad in particular ways for individuals to internalize those values that have been tailored to institutional needs. Okay, an objection. Don't we decide in some sense to put on a Fitbit each day? How could it be a lack of autonomy if you take it off each night and put it back on every morning? One response you could give that I've toyed with sometimes is that it's habitual and it's barely a decision. And it's so habitual because it's prepackaged. But I actually think, I've been thinking that it's much more important that the decision is binary. That is, the problem is one of granularity. So instead of getting to adjust the formulation of a value and the parts of the package, you either accept the whole package or you don't. You either take on the Fitbit and try to get it to motivate you, or you don't. And here's my best shot. So the level of autonomy you have with your values here is like the level of autonomy you have over the content of the end user license agreement on a piece of technology you have, right? You did technically sign it and you're responsible for it. You're minimally autonomous, but your autonomous control over your details is minimized. So value capture doesn't entirely remove your autonomy, but it puts you in the same level of autonomous control over your values as you have over your iPhone's EULA, which is the best shot I have. You might worry, don't some efforts require that we collectively organize to get to the same target? And wouldn't be value capture be great for that? For example, wouldn't it be great to value capture everyone on reducing climate change emissions and taking vaccines and wearing masks? And I kind of have to say yes. So here's a sketch of a response to this worry. So I think some goods, in fact, might be best pursued collectively, and low autonomy over those values might be good. But other goods are so entangled with our particular natures and emotional responses, they're best tailored individually, or at least at a local level. So notice that the best examples for my cases are things like your aesthetic life, your life with fitness, your choice of an exercise, your choice of a job career. And the best cases where we might really want value capture are things like climate change targets. So maybe the right view, and this is just a, this is a promissory note for future work. Maybe the right view is something like value federalism. Some values are best developed at different levels of locality. Some are best developed at the national or universal scale, and some are developed individually. And the real worry is swamping, right? It might be great that we should all collectively be value captured by the desire to decrease climate change, various climate change measures, but that we shouldn't do the same for aesthetic interests or our sports. Okay, I have time for the grand finale. Let me have some more water, because this is where the paper gets wild. Okay, I have to admit, this is also me chasing a white whale that I've chased for like 10 years. So bear with me. Maybe you might think that value capture is the ideal. Why would you think that? Let's talk about David Velleman. So David Velleman, in his early period, argues that the constitutive aim of agency is self-comprehension, that what we're trying to do is adjust our desires and our actions so they harmonize with each other, so we're comprehensible to ourselves. In his late period, he adds that constitutive aim generates a secondary aim in social circumstances, and it converges my understanding of me with your understanding of me to avoid the cognitive exhaustion of double bookkeeping. So if he's right, then value capture is the ideal. Value capture makes it easier for me to be comprehensible to myself and easier for me to be comprehensible to other people and to make other people comprehensible to me. Or, if you have my intuitions, then you take this to be a reductio. You think Velleman can't be right, and value capture helps expose why. Which is that for me, for Velleman, there's no recalcitrant self that demands loyalty. There's just this manipulable package of self-conceptions and intentions that have to be brought into alignment. And of course, the alignment needs to match the phenomenology of experience, but there's no particular reason to be loyal to our particular experiences. So why not desensitize yourself and bring your experiences into line with something that could be more easily comprehended? So if the constitutive goal of agency is self-understanding, and a secondary goal is converse social understanding, then the agent has reason to re-engineer itself along lines that are easily understood. Here's a diagnosis. Let's go back to James Scott. Remember that James Scott says that states can only see and manage the parts of the world that are legible to them. So, and this is the most interesting part of Scott, he says that states have a further motive to remake the world into terms that are more legible to them. By the way, the book is, it's amazing. He's a historian, and the book basically consists of 10 fascinating historical case studies making this point. So his examples include the gratification of cities, the simplification of land ownership laws, forests. Here's a picture from my copy. He says, for example, in the rise of German scientific engineering, forestry, we had, in the attempt to make the forest more measurable in its capacity to hit a single target, which is plank yield, early forestry managers decrease the biodiversity and replant of the forest along more even lines to make forest growth easier to measure. This is kind of a dramatic example and a drastic one, but I think it strikes me as visually striking. So here's my extension of Scott. So Scott is really interested in the legibility of things like features of the land, soil, property laws. My extension is, if our values are subtle and hard to understand and variable and privately negotiated, they'll be illegible to the state. The state would vastly prefer that we be Vellemanian agents who are motivated to reorder ourselves along lines that are easily comprehended, measurable, and targetable by the state, which suggests a further explanation for value capture. Value capture renders our interests legible to the state. So, last thing. So in the final section of Scott, there's this incredible study of polycropping. So polycropping is the agricultural procedure where you grow multiple plants in the same place and they support each other. So one kind of plant, its roots will resist erosion, another will put nitrogen in the soil, another will provide shade. So polycropping turns out to be much more productive, but it requires enormous fine-tuning to the local environment and a highly autonomous farmer. And it turns out to Scott that the decisions of highly autonomous polycropping farmers are very non-standard and hard to aggregate, and it's essentially unmanageable from the state's eye view. So he says large-scale institutions prefer large-scale monocropping, nicely organized fields where the soil has all been brought through various fertilization techniques into the same standard, which is highly legible to the state. So a general theme of Scott is that schemes of legibility tend to drive out skill and choice from the periphery into the center. So when you standardize farming, individual farmers become de-skilled and fungible and are required to execute policy that's been generated elsewhere, and power and decision-making shifts to a small number of administrators, lawyers, bureaucrats, and agricultural scientists. States, he says, tend to concentrate autonomy in the center. So I just want you to imagine a world where people autonomously develop and personalize their own aesthetic tastes along peculiar and individual grounds. That would be really hard for a large-scale institution to cater to, right? The state would vastly prefer if people's tastes followed regular and legible contours. So if you buy Scott, then the existence of value capture is really unsurprising. Institutions want to manage the world, so they have an interest in managing our values and interests. So we should expect them to use available tools like gamification to get our individual values into terms that are legible to large-scale institutions. And they'd be especially interested in getting us aligned, getting an alignment between our values and the kinds of information processing that are usable at a large-scale state level. Another way to put it is that individual values are the last frontier of legibility. Thank you.